Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Last week, my program concentrated on the political and cultural contrasts of the Yankee Doodle democracy and the evil empire. Today's curtain raiser will contrapose the half-century Cold War and nuclear terror between them, which is once again arising from the demon's pit to the fearful consternation of universal humanity. Perhaps as I articulate this personally opinionated chronicle, it might be wise to think of possible nuclear adversity as a terminal disease in which life can only be prolonged with caution and reasoned intelligence, and to especially resist fatal bouts of incipient insanity. And to remember the great movie of nuclear madness, Dr. Strangelove, which was first shown 55 years ago on January 29, 1964, and should be required viewing in every land and language. As Dr. Strangelove so aptly shows, the biggest joke is the motto of the nuclear-armed U.S. Air Force Strategic Command, "Peace is our profession." I call this our hair-trigger world. 100 years ago, at the beginning of 1919, a new nation existed in the world, born of revolution against centuries of oppressive peonage, and most recently forced conscription into World War I, which had just ended. Perhaps the most significant event of World War I was the birth of the Soviet Communist state in Russia, which was a bitter revolt against the war itself. A liberal element of upper bourgeoisie attempted to circumvent hardcore revolution by usurping the Tsar in the spring of 1917. The plot failed when Bolsheviks seized power in the October Revolution, which actually took place in November. Russia adhered to an earlier calendar at the time. Germany had cut a deal with Bolshevik leader V.I. Lenin for a truce, and the initial effect was to free German army divisions from the Eastern Front to meet the new threat of an armed America entering the side of England and France, co-belligerents against Germany. Later on, American soldiers were sent to Russia to battle the insurgent Communist Red Army in civil war against the so-called Whites of Tsarist royalists and their counter-revolutionaries. 2 decades later, Soviet Russia and Nazi Germany were the central antagonists of World War II, after an initial alliance that allowed Germany to invade Poland and Russia to occupy the eastern half, as well as to make war against Finland and swallow the Baltic states. The Great Patriotic War, as Russians called their incredibly an exorbitantly costly struggle against the Nazis, 20 million Russian dead, was the peak of the communist revolution, though the Soviets inherited an empire as spoils of the war and waged a Cold War against Western Europe and the United States, combined with Soviet-sponsored or supported wars of liberation from Western colonialism in the Third World for nearly half a century. But the immense effort to survive World War II fatally weakened the substructure of the USSR, even as it expanded into an empire. In particular, its bloated military, combined with internal corruption and social paralysis, were as lethal as syphilis, ignored for decades until insanity and death. Literally, an imploded giant red star. 2 nuclear bombs ended World War II. The 2 world wars left Europe in ruins, although the battered Allies scrambled to retrieve their former colonies in Africa and Asia. World hegemony passed to the rival new superpowers of the USA and USSR, 2 conflicting and aggressive ideologies. Allies and victors in the war against Nazism, who then swiftly divided the northern half of the world, and began a nuclear arms race that started in 1949 when Russia bootlegged nuclear technology and lasted a terrorizing half century until the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics collapsed from its own stale and worn out neuroses. the scale and breadth of the nuclear arms race and magnitude of the nuclear arsenals that grew out of it produced the means to obliterate civilization entirely. The mutual distrust and worldwide aspirations and competition that characterized the nuclear arms race between the USA and USSR spoiled virtually every opportunity for disarmament, a perplexing and often mendacious process of hammering out treaties to prevent nuclear war while simultaneously expanding the quantity and lethality of nuclear weapons. American and Soviet diplomats met thousands of times to discuss nuclear disarmament, but not a single weapon was eliminated. On the contrary, the arms race escalated relentlessly and became virtually self-propelling and might have been irreversible but for the sudden collapse of Russia's communist regime, brought on in no small part by its economic costs. The balance of terror that gripped the world for half a century was defended by arguments that only a nuclear parity between the USA and USSR could prevent a Third World War. The USA and USSR spent hundreds of billions of dollars, which would now be reckoned in trillions, developing their nuclear arsenals, each posing the threat of the other to continually escalate the race. Each claimed to be defending itself against the world-dominating aspirations of the other and the absurdly contradictory idea of preventive war. Starting a war to prevent a war was a common rationale for threatening world obliteration. The paradoxical rationale by the superpowers in their headlong race to atomized Armageddon was that neither could stop it unless the other did. An acronym for the end result of that paralysis was MAD, Mutual Assured Destruction. The Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962 foreshadowed the very real possibility of nuclear confrontation and was the catharsis for starting the process of arms negotiations. It was the closest to nuclear war the USA and USSR came. And although mutual assured destruction was not as approximate as it seemed, the high-level participators were certain they had lost control of their head-to-head encounter, and all that was left to do was mutually press the doomsday button. Attempts were made afterward to at least slow the arms race down, but years later it re-escalated with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979, and again the following year, which was a presidential election year in the USA, when not even American liberals seemed in favor of restoring negotiations. That year of 1980, the victorious right wing campaigned on a ticket of nuclear superiority. In fact, after Ronald Reagan's presidential victory, previously discredited concepts of winnable, limited nuclear wars gained popularity with civilian and military policymakers, who claimed the United States could, quote, absorb 20 million casualties in a nuclear war and continue as a functioning civilization. It can be reasonably assumed that similar scenarios were played out in the USSR, and it is probably near miraculous mutually assured nuclear genocide did not occur the last half century of the second millennium. Within four decades of the Cold War, the USA and USSR built up arsenals which together contained more than 60,000 nuclear warheads. The Soviets alone numbered some 45,000 at their peak in the late 1980s. According to Shea Williams and Jim Weathers of Cannon Beach, Oregon, in a statement that accompanied their 1983 design of a nuclear missile within a circle slashed by a red line, the USSR has enough multi-megaton nuclear warheads to bomb the USA every hour, every day for a year, or 175 bombs in each state, and use less than half its supply. And the U.S. could bomb the USSR with half our supply for almost 2 years. And that was a quote. Bannered, save the human being, they asked, why have we allowed our government to build over 50,000 nuclear warheads? Suspensions, sanctions, thunderous denouncements and intense renewal of nuclear arms competition were not unique in the history of negotiations between the USA and the USSR during the Cold War. Citizens of both the USA and USSR were hostage throughout the Cold War to the fears and oppressive secrecy the nuclear arms race invoked and diverted hundreds of billions of U.S. dollars and Russian rubles from essential social needs. Secrecy removed public participation from the issue of nuclear proliferation and made it a process of only a very few, the nuclear priesthood of political, military, and scientific experts, who in the USA manipulated the rubric of national defense to opt average Americans out of the most crucial issues of the age. Nuclear alienation was the result of this secrecy. Surrendering their right to know about nuclear policies contributed to resentment, at least among Americans, and most likely Russian citizens also, at what had been concealed and falsified. Resistance and protest against the nuclear arms race was initially subdued, and on the so-called free world side of the Iron Curtain, was treated as a public nuisance and unpatriotic. In the USA, the House Un-American Activities Committee virtually persecuted dissenters as communist sympathizers and publicly blacklisted them, especially when protest was directed against nuclear arms manufacturers. Thousands of anti-nuclear activists in the USA were arrested, though generally not sent to prison, which was a form of scare tactics designed to quell nuclear dissent. It might seem oxymoronic, but the immense fortunes made by nuclear arms manufacturers seemed to overwhelm the qualms they might have had for producing weapons that might render humanity extinct. Thousands of U.S. companies produced nuclear warhead systems for arming, transporting, and launching them. Then, during the Cold War, and they still do. Not only did the nuclear arms race grossly bloat the private fortunes of U.S. munitions makers as well as put them outside public scrutiny and accountability, it provided them with tremendous political power, which was primarily conservative and anti-democratic in nature. In the meantime, American citizens were exposed to nuclear radiation in generally unpublicized occupational accidents. But many others were deliberately exposed to measure effects of radiation on the human body, which would assist scientists and military planners formulate possible scenarios for nuclear warfare and defense, as well as design quantumly lethal nuclear irradiation and contamination. The most frequent radiation exposures on the American side, and it can be presumed the Russians carried out similar, perhaps more draconian experiments, occurred during the early years of the Cold War, when both sides were equally ignorant of the spectrum of nuclear consequences and conducted often deadly tests on live animals and humans. The most numerously affected were several thousand soldiers deployed near the ground zeros of nuclear bomb tests to determine combat capacities in nuclear war. Workers at nuclear plants and medical subjects at hospitals and universities were among those also tested, most often unknowingly. They included children, newborn infants, and apparently foreign-born subjects. Some of those tests were conducted at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in Washington State, as well as radioactive iodine purposely released into the local atmosphere in quote-unquote significant doses. Obviously, plutonium, which was manufactured at Hanford for the atomic bomb dropped on the Japanese city of Nagasaki. A 1948 document said the radiation tests were, quote, an opportunity to secure the type of medical information required to interpret in terms of human experience the toxicological findings of small animal research, unquote. Unintentional consequences of Hanford have been copious and decades-long radioactive leaks of plutonium waste into the Columbia River. The intentional and accidental release of plutonium into atmosphere and river have resulted in very high instances of thyroid cancer in residents of the region and the possibility that infants drank quantities of plutonium extract in contaminated milk from local dairies. school children all over the USA practiced so-called duck and cover drills during much of the Cold War, but were seldom taught about nuclear war, simultaneous to the development of ever more grotesque weapons. Schools were denied curricula to educate students about nuclear history and its grim consequences. Responsibility for such learning was shunted to parents and families. The flaw in that policy was that most adults then and now do not wish to know or think about it either. The abrupt end of the Cold War and the USSR banished to history's dung heap along with the 20th century, it astonished and appalled. The U.S., as the single remaining superpower, has sought to establish a millennial form of Pax Americana by reinvigorating Star Wars concepts of an inner space system of armed military satellites, nuclear and non-nuclear missiles, and lasers theoretically capable of raining deadly laser beams and hypersonic missiles down upon every place on the planet. In the meantime, developing air, sea, and land missile defense systems to protect American cities. These abrogations of the basic precepts of the Cold War, that mutual assured destruction acted as a seemingly counterintuitive but primal neutralizer to nuclear war, is essentially a restart to the Cold War nuclear arms race between the same old belligerents, each against all and all against each. The resurgence of Russia by Vladimir Putin, who would play his Ivan the Terrible to Donald Trump's fake Darth Vader, forebodes a nervously uncertain future. Add to the mix a 21st century revision of China's immemorial Golden Horde and its Dr. Strangelove all over again. In 1978, at the height of the First Cold War, a point at which hardly anyone seemed able to conceive an end to it, the United Nations belatedly reached an elusive conclusion that by then had no apparent bearing on reality, but was the only real solution: abolish nuclear weapons. The statement said in its entirety, "Nuclear weapons pose the greatest threat to mankind and the survival of civilization. It is essential to halt and reverse the nuclear arms race in all its aspects in order to avert the danger of war involving nuclear weapons. The ultimate goal in this context is the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. The most effective guarantee against the danger of nuclear war and the use of nuclear weapons is nuclear disarmament and the complete elimination of nuclear weapons." Nuclear weapons cannot be uninvented. The knowledge of them will last as long as humanity defies its own handicaps and continues to dwell in the galaxy. The development and use of atomic bombs on Japan will be disputed long after World War II diminishes to history as ancient as Caesar's campaign in Gaul. And the advent of the nuclear age might always be a topic for debate, although 1,000 years from now, if humanity is still extant, the origins of nuclear power might be as misty as the discovery of fire or first use of a hammer, two such useful essentials no one can conceive that human beings ever functioned without them, which future generations might think about splitting the atom. The nuclear arms race between the USA and the USSR for nearly 50 years represented more than anything else humanity's power to break nature, a power its possessors are existentially reluctant to ever surrender. And that was something I wrote. All right. Our hair trigger world. Pardon me for that gap. And now, something else I wrote. Today, January 31st, 1865, the U.S. House of Representatives passed the 13th Amendment to the Constitution that Abraham Lincoln worked so hard to make law of the land of the free, though he did not live long enough to see it ratified that December because he was assassinated several months earlier by a Southern white nationalist. Section 1 of the 13th Amendment abolishes slavery, which the Civil War effectively put an end to. Quote, neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction." Unquote. The story of the United States is struggle between white and black, which was at the core of the Civil War of the 1860s. The three-century genocide against Native Americans is a third leg of the racial trilogue. For most all of those three same centuries, New World whites in both American hemispheres butchered and manacled blacks, who in spite of tremendous oppression, yet managed to develop the richest culture in the Americas outside those of the original inhabitants. Whites have failed to understand why American blacks have disassociated from them. Aside from a sense that prejudice is a white prerogative, black culture is far more vibrant and instinctual, born from that slavery they overcame, while white culture is imitative of European influence, essentially extrinsic and impersonal in style and racialist exclusivity, its true orthodoxy, money and profit. From the start, white American culture proved too homogenous to form any cohesive solidarity among blacks, Native Americans, Hispanic, or Asian Americans. Blacks in America have always been a suppressed people, severed through slavery from even their indigenous origins. Slaves or free, their arduous, tragic, and unequal role in building and defending the nation has always been devalued and generally ignored. Yet the black struggle for independence and equality has been the most powerful, most original, creative, and radically dynamic in the history of this country since the first American Revolution. A persistent and heroic effort to be included in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. Certainly the guarantees as free and equal citizens by the Bill of Rights. Tomorrow, February 1st, is the beginning of Black History Month. "That blackness is most black, brothers, most black," Ralph Ellison wrote in Invisible Man. And Martin Luther King Jr. said, after being arrested with 700 other civil rights demonstrators in Selma, Alabama, on February 1, 1965, "I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right, temporarily defeated, is stronger than evil triumphant." And that was MLK. It has now been 10 years since Opium magazine experimentalized with a radically new twist on writing and reading, as well as inking. As the editor said, the end result would most likely turn the properties of aging on their heads. Because everything fades in time, print included, the magazine printed a story with so much ink on each word that only by fading over time will each word be decipherable. And each letter of each word was so layered in ink, it will only be individually deciphered over a 1,000-year period, like time-released capsules. Only in a millennium will the story be fully revealed. And only the aforementioned editor and the editor-in-chief of Opium know the full story. Obviously, within a century, or much less, if not already, both will be dead, and no one will know the entire story until at least the fourth millennium, given that this era's calendar and humanity itself remain on Earth. It might take a century or more for the ink to even dry. The editor said, back then in June 2009, that the printers responsible for the ink process thought he was insane. Perhaps the goal was for printers' ink to outlast digital print processes. Ink forever. I end today's program with a happy birthday today shout out to Toni Linton Palmateer, superb horsewoman and mother to a teenage daughter, Winter, who is a high princess of Northwest horse shows. I have known them both since they were children. They are both black American citizens and also Filipino Cajun Americans. They make the human race great again. This is Michael McCusker. what are the odds that Vernonia Veronica will see her shadow on Groundhog Day Saturday?